Thanks everyone for joining us today, tomorrow, or yesterday, or whenever it was. And I'm John Atack, and I am thoroughly delighted to welcome my good friend, Dr. Stephen Moffick. Hi, Steve.
Hi, John, and I'm always glad to be here. I always learn something from you,
Me
and
too.
you're also always a little challenging. So,
Well, good.
all set.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love our conversations. I always learn a great deal from you, so thank you so much for that. Now, you are an emeritus professor of psychiatry, is that correct?
America's?
Emeritus, emeritus. How do you say it?
Oh, I thought you said American, so
I would
I wouldn't take
never
that.
accuse you of being American, Steve. Oh.
I wouldn't take it that far. That's my own slip and probably inflated image of myself. So so yes, it's more personal to the institution I used to work for, Medical College of Wisconsin. But yeah, I mean, I don't view emeritus as any big deal, actually. It's sometimes just for the longevity of somebody's service, to an academic institution. I don't think it implies much of quality or anything that's really important.
Okay. Well, we could say you're an erstwhile professor of psychiatry if you prefer. But
I actually turned down the opportunity to be to become an emeritus professor of where I was because I thought the institution, the medical school, was having trouble's not the right word. It was on its wrong ethical pathway, and so I just wanted a kind of clean break with this medical school.
Right. Well, I got far more than I bargained for there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's always more in some of these issues. It just depends whether we want to go deeper or not. So, yeah.
And how much deeper we're going to go. So, I mean, my point is that you know a bit about psychiatry, yeah?
Say
Don't
that
you?
again.
You know a bit about psychiatry, one way or another, yeah?
So some people say, but it's, psychiatry's it's another deeper issue. I mean, it's a field where we think we know a lot, and I think we do, but there's so much more we need to learn and discover, not pretend that we really have the answers for lots of things. We're a work, a field in progress, and you could really say our field is only about 100 years old. Some people take it back longer than that, but I think modern psychiatry is just a century old, whereas general medicine is thousands of years old. So, yeah.
And our understanding has changed so much that if we look at, the formulations of, say, Wilhelm Wundt in the 19th century and Freud and Charcot and Janet, these important names, there's not a lot that we agree with in those things anymore. Janet perhaps more than the others, but and that really does it really does take us to our subject for today. Our subject for today is post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is a very modern idea. It's late 20th century, after the middle of the 20th century, this term comes along. It started its life probably in the late 19th century when the word trauma was first used by, was he an alienist or a psychiatrist? It's hard to know. But it first, I think I read about this yesterday. That's why it's still in my head. 1889 was the first use of the word trauma to mean a psychological wound as opposed to a physical wound. The word Traum means wound. It also means dream if you go into German, so it gets very confusing. And this idea came along. It was called shell shock in the First World War. The movie Birdsong tells you about Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen, two of the greatest poets who ever wrote, I believe, and their treatment by Dr. Rivers. And this came on to be called combat fatigue. There are various names for it. And after the Second War, it was recognized that a profoundly traumatic experience could leave lingering symptoms that could linger from then on. You know, there were some people who didn't recover from this. Much more recently, about 25 years ago, Judith Herman and a few other people put forward the idea that there was a form of post-traumatic stress disorder that they called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which didn't come from a single triggering incident, you know, seeing something catastrophic happen to one of your friends on the battlefield, for example, but came from having lost the locus of control, having lost control of your life, so being pretty much a slave. And this is something that we saw happening in authoritarian groups, such as the Moonies, the Krishnas, the Way International. Oh, there are so many of them. There are about 2,000 of them. And in Scientology, of course. I did not experience this in any way. I was never a live-in member of Scientology. I had a perfectly reasonable, non-humiliating, let's say, experience of Scientology. So, but after I came out and started talking with hundreds and hundreds of people who'd been in Scientology, some of them were certainly showing signs of distress, I'm going to call it that. And I, you know, before challenging you in some way, which I'm determined to do now you've said that, I'd just like to say that I've worked with about 600 people in their recovery, not as a counselor, just as somebody to hold their hand and help them to, you know, think what they're thinking, you know, and get to what they want to do and think, rather than, you know, giving them my own way of being or something, which hasn't served me tremendously well, so I'm not trying to sell it. But most of those 600 people recovered, and they recovered in weeks. And you know, so very only a very small number for whom this the trauma persisted for a long time. And I think that's a very important starting point. I'm going to talk about George Bonanno, who is Columbia Teaching College at Columbia University, and wrote a book called The End of Trauma. And he did research which largely shows that what is being labeled as post-traumatic stress disorder does have a natural period to it. And that, of course, we are affected by trauma, but most people, the majority of people, are resilient to trauma. And the example he gives is 9/11, where trauma centers were set up all over the place, and a huge amount of counselors were brought in, and very few people used their services. Even when they started going to institutions and stopping people on the street and saying, "Are you traumatized?" And initial surveys which showed at least one symptom of PTSD in a massive amount of New Yorkers, we have to question, because one of those symptoms is insomnia. And I would imagine quite a lot of those people had insomnia before 9/11. Another is anxiety. And so we get into a place where 9/11 kind of showed that this epidemic of PTSD that we were anticipating, this tsunami of PTSD, didn't actually occur. So that's enough. That's enough for me. Say something. Just tell me something about PTSD.
Oh, well, yeah, there's lots to comment about your historical, approach to it. And maybe there's too much for me to say. I just will say a couple of things. One, although Freud is very controversial about his ideas nowadays, he did deal with trauma in a very, what turns out to be an erroneous way. He did realize there was real trauma to some of his early patients, sexual trauma, incest, so on. But he ended up feeling that it was going to be unacceptable to the public to convey that. And it's unclear whether he actually really believed it or not. But then he translated that into a fantasy. That is, you want to have sex with one of your parents. You didn't really, but you wanted to. It was a fantasy. And I think that misled us in the field for decades until what you bring up, and it became a formal sort of diagnosis after the Vietnam War. And that's what did it, because the war was so controversial in the United States, and there were so many soldiers who, number one, weren't welcome back home, and number two, developed some sort of disorder that we didn't understand and finally traced it back to prior traumatic situations like war and rape and so on. And we finally came up with this official diagnosis. Now I think it's a little bit problematic to divide post-traumatic stress disorder into the traditional one. You have one horrendous episode, and the key thing there is you think or it is threatening your life, versus more complex PTSD, where there's more of an ongoing sort of trauma of lesser, in quotes, severity. But I think even with the major PTSD one episode trauma, it's complicated. As you implied, not everybody gets post-traumatic stress disorder after something horrendous. There is a certain percentage that do seem to, no matter what, maybe 5-10%. But the rest depends on the person's biology, the person's history of other trauma, whether the trauma feels like a moral injury in addition to the physical one. And so it's complicated, and it's hard to know where to draw the line. And then we get to a stage now where trauma is an everyday term. It's thrown out there for most anything that's stressful and maybe is diluting the whole concept too much. So it's very complicated, let alone how hard it is to treat when it really does fit some sort of psychiatric disorder classification.
Yeah, and I mean, I read a paper recently that cited another paper that said that for a major depressive disorder, there are 277 possible combinations of symptoms. For post-traumatic stress disorder, there are 636,120 possible combinations, which indicates that we are dealing with something that is a huge grab bag, that to find symptoms and register this thing with so many possibilities means it for me it's like the medical term fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue disorder or irritable bowel syndrome, that don't describe a specific condition. They describe symptoms, they describe the effects of whatever the condition is. And certainly with chronic fatigue disorder, I spent some time looking at this because two of my kids were diagnosed with it, and I'm not happy with that diagnosis. And looking into it, it seemed that there were at least five different potential causes for this. With fibromyalgia, you've got, I think it's pain in 9 out of 19 areas of the body, and that's then called fibromyalgia. It's kind of like phlogiston. It's kind of like we know that if you burn stuff, it's got less weight afterwards, so it must have given something off. Let's call that something phlogiston. And of course, is it Lavoisier who came along and worked out oxygen and, that other things are happening when you burn things and this substance. So at the moment we're naming the thing and we've got some idea of symptoms, but we may be pulling so many symptoms into one place that to recommend a kind of generalized treatment may not be. We may not know enough about this condition yet. And as you say, we've now been traumatized. And you use the word whenever there's, you said something like whenever there's stress, we then regard as trauma. Let's back into the word stress. The word stress entered the language in the 1960s. The idea of psychological stress was promoted very heavily by the tobacco companies, with the idea that you can relieve stress by smoking a cigarette. And that has come into our world so that we think about, I'm so stressed out. There's so much stress in the world. And this is a term that starts its life in engineering and has moved into, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying that we're conceptualizing trauma, we're conceptualizing stress, and we maybe need to get a more precise idea of what different stresses and different traumata there are.
Yeah, well, I would say stress is quite different than trauma. I think stress is part of everyday life. Sometimes people react to it and deal with it in a very helpful way, obviously without any help. And there's a certain amount of stress that seems to goad people to get through the challenges of life. And then there's too much stress. trauma, I think, again, we're dealing with something deeper and much scarier. And I think those numbers you threw out are could be interpreted in a different way, which is that if you combine some of the most prominent different symptoms, how they express themselves varies with individuals. And I think that's what leads to the big numbers. I think, you know, if you go back in history, there's so many examples of trauma in wartime, going back to the Iliad and all sorts of major literature, Shakespeare and so forth. So we know something like this exists. You know, where to draw the line is a challenge. But when you use the term shell shock, that's been used throughout history, and at least after we got guns and weapons and loud noises as part of that. But that refers to a symptom of numbness. Numbness is a prominent symptom in PTSD. We don't really see it and get it in other psychiatric disorders, at least as we know them. So you could say that definitely fits PTSD. And there's a two or three others that are just essential. And I think honing in on those is what's useful. So I'm not at all worried about all these variations. The important thing is to analyze these in a given individual person or patient. You know, what's prominent? How strong does it seem to be? How is it affecting their everyday life? And, you know, actually, after 9/11, I think certainly we in mental health made some mistakes, actually. You know, there was this term debriefing after any major trauma, and that was done after 9/11. It actually seemed to make people worse rather than helping them. And as you indicated, many people recovered on their own. But the debriefing, sort of forcing people to talk right away before they were ready to, is problematic. And we don't do that so much anymore. So the hard part now, I think, isn't discovering where people and when people need help. It's how to help them. That's the much bigger challenge. And, you know, DSM-5, the diagnostic classification, it's a work in progress, is the best I can say. You know, the line is drawn as so many conditions, and it's controversial. We can't really connect it to obvious physical abnormalities like they do in the rest of medicine. So, you know, it's a trial and error sort of progress. You know, the main thing is, how do we help people when they want and need the help? And certainly that occurs often in trauma. By the way, you know, we also take it at higher levels that whole groups can be traumatized, maybe nations. There's this idea that Israel now is a traumatized nation. Probably Gaza is too. America maybe itself, you know, for what we went through, this concept that a whole country can be traumatized, and it affects then, if that's true, how they react to the continuing traumas and the triggers to trauma. Triggers is a big deal, and we didn't understand that so much in the past, but a trigger means something happens that reminds you of the past trauma, and the past trauma that you may have even closed out of your conscious mind. And so that's a big deal. It relates to intergenerational transmission of trauma, which is another important concept that relates to Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, and on and on, and hard to break, both for individuals and for groups. So it's a wide-ranging concept of immense importance in individuals and in our world nowadays.
Yes, I think so. And it's become an essential concept. Curiously, two things that you just mentioned are two things that George Bonanno brings up. First is the Iliad. And he puts forward the point that although physical trauma is happening throughout that text, which he dates it to 1000 BC, I've seen it dated to 800 BC, you know, whatever. It's a war between the Hittites in Troy and the Mycenaean Greeks, which, according to the archaeological digs of Schliemann, seems to have actually happened. I think there's one letter that mentions Agamemnon in the Hittite archives, you know, it's very wonderful things. But There is no talk about psychological trauma. There's the grief of the death of your friends, but it's not viewed in the same way. Again, you mentioned...
Just as an aside, John, you know, the Purple Heart that the American Army gives to soldiers of immense heroic action does not fit PTSD because there's not a visible physical trauma. And so since you can't see the trauma, PTSD doesn't count the same as major physical injuries. Mm. And getting financial help along the way then becomes controversial. But we still have that even in our American armed forces.
Yeah, absolutely. The other point, you mentioned Shakespeare, and Bonanno brings up Henry IV and reckons that that's the first time that psychological trauma is mentioned. I don't think that's true. I think that there is a Greek reference, which is, I'm trying to remember the what's his name, the father of medicine, the Hippocrates. Hippocrates is meant to have said something like, you know, you haven't got over an illness until you've told at least three friends about it, or something like that. So there is recognition of it. But the cultural aspect of it and the aspect of traumatizing people as a part of culture. And I think, yeah, we have seen a shift. If we look back to, he said that Voltaire was the first, I've read that Voltaire was the first person to publicly protest the use of torture as a, you know, and that cannot be right, but I've read this, that it was taken for granted that as part of the process of execution, people would be publicly tortured. They'd be hung, still alive. They'd have their entrails, their innards drawn out and burned in front of their eyes. And eventually they would be quartered, hung, drawn and quartered. It was a standard process. People would go to watch executions. So you have another example would be Chinese foot binding, where trauma is visited as an aspect of the culture. And I think and I hope that we're getting a little bit better about that.
Well, that's very interesting examples, John, that I hadn't thought of. We have to also consider whether trauma is culturally congruent or not, socially congruent. Because if it is, as an example to use, it may not feel like a trauma to the observers.
Yes, actually. Good point. Yeah.
The same with some other social problems like racism and so forth that are just embedded in the culture. And so although those examples seem horrendous to many of us now, maybe it didn't in the past. So how society views these things is, I think, also important for how actual traumatic they seem to people and whether they end up suffering after them. And then there's a whole other concept, which if these examples of yours really were traumatizing, is important, which is the concept of secondary trauma, meaning how much are you exposed to trauma in other people in your life? And it's actually an occupational hazard of being a psychiatrist if you take care of traumatized patients. And that's true of some of the rest of medicine too. If you do that enough, the trauma becomes imbued in you. You end up with some symptoms of it. You don't even realize it. I had it. It was part of why I retired, but I didn't know it until I actually retired and felt sort of free from what was affecting me so strongly. So that secondary trauma is also an important consideration because the public who is exposed to a lot of important trauma can develop that without even realizing it.
Yeah, it becomes everyday behavior. It's how we think it is. And I absolutely go along with that, that because I spoke out against Scientology, and there weren't many people doing that back in the 1980s, they attacked me and I was harassed pretty much on a daily basis for 16 years. I ended up in litigation in New York and here. I think there were in all about 10 court cases that I was directly involved in. And it was an incredibly debilitating process.
Yeah.
And then towards the end of that, I actually, I was accused of being mentally ill. And so I went to a psychiatrist who is a very eminent, and she assessed me psychiatrically and determined that apart from a little unhappiness at being harassed, that I wasn't suffering from any psychiatric disorder. But she very specifically assessed me for PTSD. And I was quite interested because my daily life was not easy. I was quite interested to find that she wasn't finding symptoms of PTSD. She didn't think I had PTSD.
Yeah, you had a normal response to an abnormal or stressful system, what was happening to you, but your reaction was, quotes, normal, appropriate.
And it because I dealt with so many people who were, some of the things that had happened to the people I spoke to. And there is a particular set of cases that because children were neglected in Scientology, so those of us who are so-called public Scientologists lived relatively normal lives. And our kids went to ordinary schools. I didn't have any kids when I was in, so my kids didn't go to any schools because I didn't have any kids at that time. But kids who are in certain Scientology facilities didn't go to school, didn't have contact with the outside, didn't have proper caregivers, were not properly fed. I mean, I talked to one woman who she was six when her parents joined. It's called the Sea Organization, SEA, as in a body of water. And she said that the most significant memory she had, and she told me horrible stories of what had happened, which I've confirmed with many other people over the years. She said the main thing was being starving hungry all the time. And she talked about 80 children having one adult to supervise them. She had watched as her own brother drowned. He was 8 years old, and they were taken to the seaside, and there was nobody properly looking after them. And she internalized that guilt. She decided it was her fault, which is again not untypical, particularly for children, to believe that they're responsible for things. So these absolutely terrible situations will bring about certainly a form of post-traumatic, or can bring about a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. I've also seen people who went through that childhood who managed to become very successful. And some of them managed to become successful even though they were experiencing PTSD, which is an interest, the resilience that it must take to be able to do that is quite
Exactly.
something.
Exactly. Yeah. And developing resilience is so important. Generally speaking, it takes talking about what happened to you as far as the trauma goes. It requires some support from loved ones or the community around you, which I assume happens, for people who get out of cults, hopefully, often. But most important, a revised vision of the future, a revised vision of your values. And I think it's that revised vision that can lead some people to do extraordinary things because they've learned things about trauma and other aspects of life that they wouldn't have known otherwise. So if they can use that more generally in a helpful way, they have certain insights that other people won't. So you can't expect that out of most people who go through horrendous trauma, but yes, you definitely can out of some people, and we hear that a lot about situations where a child dies suddenly for whatever reason, and it's fairly obvious that it could have been prevented. And so the parents will then devote themselves to doing things that will stop the same sort of thing from happening to other people. And they do tremendous work in that regard because the deaths are traumatic to them and they don't want that to happen empathetically to other parents. So, you don't want to have bad trauma to have more resilience and good things come out of it, but it can. You just don't want that to have to be the avenue for that to happen.
Yeah, it is said that Sufi Muslims pray for hardship so that they may learn. And the thing is, not having too much hardship, it's having just enough hardship that you can bear it. And certainly, people who have endured, you made me think about some friends of mine, a couple whose son committed suicide as a young man. And they were among the first people, this was in the 1990s, complaining about the internet and despicable people who groom people to harm themselves, who damage themselves on the internet. It's a shame that that campaign still hasn't been completely successful 20, 30 years later now. But they turned the terrible thing that awful, unbelievable thing that had happened to them into something positive for other people. They probably, very probably, saved lives as a consequence of what they did. So, and yeah, that resilience is an interesting thing. Viktor Frankl talking about logotherapy in an appendix to Man's Search for Meaning, a book that everybody should read. Frankl talks about a client who was quadriplegic, and he went to the client with the expectation that this man would be, completely depressed and dejected about everything, and was very surprised when the man said, "No, the accident, the car crash, was a good thing because I was a bad person before, and it made me assess the world in a different way and understand, how fantastic it is to be alive." So, I mean, I don't think I'd feel that way if I was quadriplegic, but I do accept that there is, as Schopenhauer said, the life of the mind. And that we can be moral, virtuous, intelligent creatures, as well as simply being animal, physical creatures. But I would quite like to keep the use of my limbs, if I may, because I find them useful. What can I say?
Yeah, and Viktor Frankl, as you mentioned, is essential to understanding the potential good that could come out of horrendous trauma. I mean, he developed his ideas in the concentration camp of the Nazis, and what was essential to his ideas and what is essential to logotherapy and what's called existential psychotherapy is finding meaning in your life. And so if you find meaning, that makes the suffering less severe, and you could feel something good has come out of that. And it certainly did for him personally. He, went on to a very meaningful life, educating other people about trauma, helping them, and so on and so forth. So he's a terrific example. And he said from his own informal studies during the concentration camps is those people's who could find some meaning still in the situations were the ones who were going to be more likely to survive. That didn't always happen, of course, because you weren't in control of your surviving, but you could contribute to that, and that's what he noticed. So.
Yeah, and I mean, he had the fundamental ideas of logotherapy before he went to Dachau and then on to Auschwitz. But as you say, he survived actually by rehearsing the lectures he was going to give on the subject.
Well,
And
yeah,
so,
he had a book in progress, before he was in concentration camp, and the book was lost or destroyed or whatever.
yeah,
And
the manuscript he said was
thankfully, he
destroyed
could
by the Nazis.
remember most of the ideas, and maybe his experience added quite a bit to them,
Oh,
obviously.
I think it did. I mean, there's another wonderful book. A friend of mine is a professor of psychology, said that she thinks The Doctor and the Soul is the most important book she's read. So, and I mean, it is. It's a brilliant book. And you're looking at, he's one of those people who you get that he's looking at the world from his own perspective. He's not been trained to look at the world this way. He's, Milton Erickson's another one who, they have a very unique perspective of the world. I mean, I'm not sure I go all the way with Milton Erickson, but he had remarkable skills, which very few people seem to be able to duplicate. His teaching doesn't lead to being able to do it. Having polio as a child and, being restricted so much gave him an advantage. It allowed him, you know, exactly what we're saying, that his resilience to trauma gave him insights that he could share. And I do agree with you that is so often the case, that if you can digest and integrate the trauma, then you can be helpful to other people. And the reality is, there is no life without trauma. You know, as Joseph Campbell said, we all made the hero's journey on the day that we were born. You know, we all had to do that. So trauma is going to be reality.
And Campbell's also a great person to know about in his whole concept of heroic journeys that all of us can make, but we have to get through traumatic situations. And, you just reminded me too of my, I guess, my own experience of some trauma, which I didn't realize for a long time. Today is President's Day in the United States, but it's also the birthday of my late mother. And the central trauma from my growing up, at least what I remember, we all always have to remember we've all probably had significant trauma, as you say, but we may not remember it. But as I went on into psychiatry, I remembered it when I was 4 or 5 years old. My mother, who had a severe cardiac disease, all of her adult life and during my child rearing, I went to a store with her and she had a severe heart issue occur where she fainted. And I remember seeing this happen and being terrified. But I didn't remember it for many, many years. But it was important in my growing up, how I dealt with this as a child and then as a psychiatrist, because most of us in psychiatry do some sort of soul searching about our own background. Freud did it. But this was an essential trauma of my childhood. And I grew up thinking my mother was going to die any day, especially if I did something wrong that upset her. So, but it may have had, as we're talking about, it may have had, helpful implications for how I dealt with the world and even being in the field of psychiatry.
Well, you know, I'd say I was harassed a great deal, and it was, I was always just this side of it, you know, the breaking point. And there were so many points where probably if Scientology's harassment teams had actually been fully competent, they would have been able to push me over the edge, because it's very full on. You know, they do everything they can possibly do to make your life hard. You know, so one of the things is, they do this thing called noisy investigation. This is actually all written up and was reprinted in the British government report in 1971, how to do a noisy investigation. So you get a list of somebody's friends, family, their contacts, that, you know, their doctor, their dentist, what have you, and you ring all of those people up and you say, I'm doing a criminal investigation into this person. I've already found some remarkable things. It's so that you give this idea. I had this done to me. I had a private detective who was a disgraced LAPD detective called Eugene Ingram, and he traveled all around the world. You know, he found my girlfriend from when I was 19, who was now in Australia, and interviewed her and used this technique on them. Came to my parents' house. My father was very, very ill, and he didn't recover. But you know, he kind of, they went to my brothers, went to my in-laws, went here, there, and everywhere with this kind of spiel. And it's, you know, it's just relentless. And then any little bit of gossip they can pick up, any little bit of calumny they can find, they will print and put forward. And you'll be accused of being a drug dealer, a drug addict, a thief, you know, a burglar, a child abuser. That one is standard to anybody who opposes Scientology. A rapist, you know, the usual things. I was only accused of attempted murder. I wasn't accused of actual murder. But it, you know, life starts to become like kind of swimming through mud, that on a daily basis you're waking up to this, and more of it's going on. And thankfully, people don't believe them. But because, you know, so even if I had done any of those things, nobody would believe it, because it was Scientology saying it. To live in that constant stress, and I had to say I had probably 16 years solid of that before eventually I just threw in the towel. And they wanted to, they offered to pay me an income, a stipend for the rest of my life if I would never say anything about them again. And I must say I was a little bit rude to the man who suggested that to me, and I do apologize for that. But this thought of, you know, being bought off and all of this, and of course so many people are, so many people just, and there was just something as a matter of principle, it just wasn't possible for me to do that. So what I had to do was basically just walk away and not be involved for, it ended up being 17 years that I didn't say anything publicly. And they didn't pay me anything. So that's 17 years income I lost. I'm a
Yes,
fool.
it worked,
What am
huh?
I doing here? You know?
Yeah. You
Damn.
know, unfortunately, you know, that's among the worst situations. But on the internet, we have that so much more in general now of, you know, searching for something to blast another person that's maybe irrelevant or part of normal development and publicly posting that on the internet. You know, conspiracy theories, and so on. So somehow wider society has taken up what Scientology and other cults did more extensively and intensively, but it's more widespread nowadays, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I mean the fact that you know, after I left Scientology, about 6 months after I left, and I was sort of going, well, I've done 6 months of this, so somebody else can do this now. What's the most dangerous cult in the world? I'll go after that. And the answer didn't take long in coming. The most da two most dangerous cults in the world were the KGB and the CIA. And the behavior that we've attributed here to Scientology was perfectly normal in those agencies. Anything you could do, you know, Castro's exploding cigar or putting thallium salts in his socks so that his beard would fall out, or you know,
Well, Novotny just last week being killed.
so yeah, I when he went back to Russia, I was just sort of, this is not going to end well, is it?
Yes.
But
Exactly.
a very courageous man and a very despicable regime, sadly. And one that does, you know, as we say, that there is this cultural setting for trauma and the way that, you know, I was thinking earlier that initiations in what we used to call primitive people or first people, they're, you know, we've called them Aborigines, natives. There are, the words have to keep changing because they're considered to be insulting,
Indigenous, yeah,
indigenous people.
and no, yeah.
And first peoples, you know, which actually first and primitive mean the same thing. You know, there we go. But nonetheless, all over the world, and again, Joseph Campbell wrote a great deal about this, as did Mircea Eliade, that there'll be initiation ceremonies when a boy gets to be 12 or 13, and it, you know, the bar and bat mitzvahs in the Jewish community echo this point of transition into adulthood. But if we look at that in New Guinea or Australia or you know, New Zealand or among first Americans, Native Americans, then these ceremonies can be, you know, terrifying, like the bull roarers that are used in Aborigine ceremonies. There is often an infliction of wounds, you know, people, you know,
Circumcision, yeah.
young lads will be cut. The Apache one, I believe, is to take a rattlesnake and whap it onto your wrist, and so that you are, and you'll have 3 days of hallucinations, and you may or may not survive. Now, it's a very simplistic form of the survival of the fittest. I mean, because it means that people who are fit to digest snake poison will survive, and that's all the fitness is actually measured. But this idea of creating a nightmare experience for somebody, so that they will no longer be afraid. They will be braves, to use the word that used to be used. They will have become men, and they will stand up in battle and they will fight without fear. So there was this idea of inducing, you know, sometimes by actually giving wounds, traumas. There's a point where Sitting Bull, the great Sachem of the Lakota people, couldn't attend a battle because he had 180 wounds that he had inflicted on himself as part of his religious ceremony. And he was not capable that day of fighting. It's sort of so, and we hear of, you know, Campbell talks about losing a finger joint to sacrifice a bit of your finger so that you'll be a better archer. It doesn't make sense to me. I think you need all your fingers to be a good archer. But that, so trauma is bound up in normal human life. And
those are fascinating examples you brought up, because, you know, it sounds like they run the gamut from trauma that's induced that is too much, although maybe just right for that society or culture, to more benign trauma, and finding the sweet spot in how design trauma can help somebody growing up is actually quite a challenge. But I think there's something really important in what you say. Again, just an aside for myself, you mentioned bar mitzvahs. And so, you know, most Jewish children go through a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah for girls nowadays. And is that traumatic in any way? I mean, it's supposed to be a milestone to becoming an adult. For me, what was traumatic about that? Probably speaking in public at the time was traumatic. But
yeah, exactly.
Since I can't say it was a major trauma, I think it turned out to be helpful, but it had its traumatic aspects. But I think nowadays it's designed not to be traumatic in any sort of way to Jewish kids. You know, it's designed to be pretty easy, and you have a party afterwards and so on. But there's something to that. How does society use adolescence in a way that's helpful in a mild traumatic sense for kids? It's really important what you brought up there, because it's got the whole range of culturally induced trauma there.
Yeah, and our maturation is accepting the reality of the world. That you know, when the Buddha was a young prince and was allowed out from the perfect environment, and he saw old age, disease, and death, and which were things he had not been taught about. I mean, he must have been a very slow learner, I think, if he hadn't worked out these things happen. But never mind. He went out and saw these things, and the point is that you cannot protect any human being from being upset, from being distressed. And it is, to what extent can we benefit, you know, if we are not overwhelmed, or if we come back from being overwhelmed and can take this on. And of course, for soldiers, you are looking at a, you know, this is pretty nasty stuff. My dad was he joined the British Army as soon as World War II began. He lied about his age to do it. As we later found. And he was at Dunkirk, one of the most horrific events in human history. He was at Normandy landings, and he was at the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. And he didn't talk about those things. And my mum said that certainly for 10 years after the war, he would wake up screaming in the night, which is, you know, a very typical effect. Yeah. Associated with post-traumatic stress
key
disorder.
Key symptom.
And I can't say that you know, hypervigilance is another, people being, you know, highly sensitive, you know, the startle response, that if there's a banging noise, they drop to the ground because they got used to bombs around them and explosions. He didn't seem to, you know, I'm stopping and thinking about this because I'd never thought about it, but he didn't seem to show hypervigilance, this... but he'd gone through hell.
But the opposite of that is what I mentioned before, really.
Numbness.
It's
numbness. Yeah.
So it's like the two poles of your nervous system, parasympathetic and sympathetic. And it can go in either direction. So, you know, maybe he was more numbed from what happened rather than, you know, hypervigilant. So
I think you're right.
So how did you find out? What happened to him? Was it from your mother, or did he finally talk about it to you, or?
He not in any depth. It was just mentioned where he'd been. He never imparted. He told me that I think he actually at Dunkirk he came away from the port of Ostend in Belgium rather than Dunkirk itself, and he said that he woke up in the morning behind enemy lines, and as he was leading a group of mechanics, I'm not sure they were armed. They acted, so that must have been truly terrifying. But yeah, I mean, I'm having to stop and reflect here. I think you hit the nail on the head that he was kind of withdrawn, towards the end of his life. And I had a very good relationship with my father for the last 10 years of his life, probably.
Good, good.
That leading up to that, but he came to me, a few months before he died, and he apologized to me for never spending any time with me when I was a child.
Oh,
And I can't say that I'd ever thought about it. I got three older brothers, and my mum was very affectionate, and lots of friends. And he was this character who would come home from work, sit in his chair, shake out the Financial Times and put some Mozart on, and then he'd be out in the garden, had a large garden, about a third of an acre. He was digging for victory still, as we said in this country. But yeah, he kept himself away. He didn't have any close friendships, but when he died, many people contacted us because he'd actually made a very positive impression on many people's lives.
Good.
But yeah, I think he was that thing that so many people do, that you learn to dissociate because reality is too painful.
Yes.
And I've seen it. Arthur Bookman, a friend of mine who's in American living in Denmark, and he was in a group where he was put in solitary confinement for 12 years. He didn't see another human being for 12 years. And I kind of talked to him, and I sort of put it to him that maybe he'd created a panic room inside himself and that he could withdraw into this place. And I'm pretty sure I've seen that with other people. And the problem is, and I think Arthur seemed to me to be in perfectly good shape when I knew him, just a few years ago now. So I think he dealt with it. I think he'd cope with it. He'd become a psychologist. He was a therapist, and I think
Oh.
he'd understood what had happened to him, and was helping other people.
Yeah.
I think with many people, they create that panic room and they retreat into it. So if you say anything that they feel is critical of them, they'll say, "You're gaslighting me." They'll be, "Whoa." And they can't talk about what happened to them. If they do talk about it, it's too distressing.
Too painful.
We this subject came up because a few weeks ago I asked you, a couple of months ago, I asked your advice about a book called The Invisible Machine, written by Jamie Mustard. And claiming that by injecting anesthetic into the stellate ganglia, which are part of your sympathetic nervous system on either side of your neck, that you could overcome all of the symptoms of PTSD, you could be cured of PTSD, and in fact, the promotion for the book says that you will be pain-free from then on, which seems to me a hyperbolic claim, because I don't think that the pain in our body is completely controlled by the stellate ganglia. My thought, you said you came back you immediately and said it's plausible. This idea that you can help PTSD with this injection is plausible, but where are the studies? And I've now had a chance to look at four of the studies. And I made this division when we started talking between what I think of as combat PTSD and complex PTSD, something that's been, you've lived as a slave fundamentally to somebody else's wishes and have developed these symptoms. And none of the studies, and I asked for studies last November when this was first brought up to me, none of the studies are about complex PTSD. And their studies are military studies, which makes them, I'm afraid, questionable, because in the US, the military can do whatever they like to soldiers and they can't They're not legally responsible. So there's no comeback for any treatment they do. If it kills you, you can't, your family can't sue. And of course, they're also desperate to get people back into battle or out of the Veterans Administration hospital. So there's a kind of bias there. I also wasn't able to find a longitudinal study that said, it's 3 years ago this happened and now the person's fine.
What you're bringing up, talking about complex PTSD, it's a complex subject matter. I guess what I would say about whether that technique can be helpful at best is this. So you anesthetize the nerve pathways, the sympathetic nerve pathways, which has to do with hypervigilance that you mentioned before. It has to do with bodily reactions to trauma. There's a famous book, The Body Keeps Score, by one of the psychiatrists expert in PTSD.
Bessel van der Kolk, I'm afraid, has run into rather a lot of trouble since he published that book and has had to leave the US.
Sort of a complex reaction and his own complex history, but I think there's some validity to that whole idea that the sympathetic nervous system overreaction can affect your body. Now, that has little to do and may be more harmful if your symptoms are along the numbing side, right? Because you don't want to be numbed even more. So
No.
let's just say the anesthesia there can help dampen hypervigilance, hypersympathetic reactions. Okay, that could be helpful, but does it last? I mean, it's only designed by the medication to last a month, maybe a little longer. So what happens after that? It's worn off. So if people are still helped after that, what's the explanation? Placebo effect? Maybe. Did they get any psychotherapy during that month that the injection was helping? And then it would be something like giving a psychedelic for PTSD, that you have a therapist there and to follow up to add on to the effect of the psychedelic. Okay. I haven't seen that in any of the literature about this technique, so that's probably not there. So my hunch is at best is that it's a placebo response to some. What I've read is along the lines you say, there's nothing substantial other than case studies by those who are advocating for this technique and maybe making a lot of money off of it to advocate for.
$2,000 a jab.
Yeah, because you have to have comparative study, randomized controlled studies to really tease out whether a technique is helpful or not. And actually, it would be a great study to compare this to the use of psychedelics in PTSD now. Now that would be a fascinating study.
It would.
On the other hand, treating PTSD is so difficult, and so many things have been tried. It would be terrific if we found an easy cure. Probably the closest to that nowadays is the use of ketamine, but that's also fraught with a lot of complexity and uncertainty. So, but we want something like that. We want something that's more sure of helping. And so I think that technique just latched onto that. Maybe it does help, in quotes, certain people, but by no means do I see anything that suggests that the technique itself has long-standing effects on significant PTSD, other than potential placebo effects, which are fine. I have nothing against
Let's
placebo
use
effects
them. Yeah.
whatsoever. So, I think it's very questionable, and I think people have to be very careful about trying this. There's probably nothing major harmful about trying it other than spending the money. Side effects, as far as I understand it, are probably limited in the long term, unless the injection is done wrong, which it can be, and then cause damage. Otherwise, the effects wear off, and so I wouldn't say there's probably any major side effects likely to happen, but I sure wouldn't pick that as any kind of expectation that it's going to be a likely long-term help.
Yeah, I mean the claim is being made that it is more important than Jonas Salk's work on the polio vaccine. It is as important as penicillin, and I kind of look at this and go, no, this is hyperbole.
Yeah, you know, there's all kinds of medical treatments in the past that were promised to be cure whatever. The lobotomy on the brain, you know, sticking in a pointed instrument into your brain to diminish various
Aggression, for
untreated
example, yeah.
symptoms. And I bet trauma was part of the patient's history, many patients. And you just ablate the area of the brain and the person becomes blah, you know, kind of
Like
nothing.
Jack Nicholson at the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is
Yeah,
not
so
much good to anyone.
we have all these claims in history of medicine and psychiatry, and you got to take something new with a grain of salt, you know. On the other hand, you know, you take something in PTSD like EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. You know, at first that seemed so weird to most psychiatrists, like, how could that possibly help moving your eyes back and forth from the left to the right? And the discoverer of that was a psychologist, and she noticed that happening
Shapiro.
within herself. Yeah. And of course, insurance companies wouldn't cover this for a while, but you know, then good studies evolved, and it does seem to help, or even variations of it help. You could alternately tap, and the key is to do that while you're thinking of the past trauma. It kind of desensitizes them, and then you could reprocess, almost like what happens with psychedelics. And why I said maybe that could happen with injections. But anyways, it's a more standard treatment nowadays, and I wouldn't hesitate to recommend that to somebody who knows, who's an expert in giving it. But it seemed like an unusual treatment at the time. You know, there's no safe medication. There's nothing like an antidepressant, so-called anti-anxiety, so-called antipsychiatry, I mean psychotic. There's no anti-trauma. That term isn't used because there is no medication that you can use that you know is going to hit the core symptoms. So medication at best is an ancillary. And all sorts of psychotherapeutic techniques have evolved. Some of them seem quite promising, others go by the wayside and you shouldn't use them. And but it's just a terribly difficult condition to treat, in part because so much of the trauma is buried. And how do you get it out at a rate that the patient can feel comfortable enough to reprocess it, which is part of the name of EMDR. So
Yeah, I mean, I have a tremendous hesitation about EMDR. It's been around in my field for 30 years and was soundly criticized by Margaret Singer and Janne Jelenic in their book Crazy Therapies some time ago. It's evidently a hypnotic technique. It's a technique that Shapiro learned studying Milton Erickson's methods. And she, in fact, gives two quite different origin stories as to how she came upon the technique, which makes it a little bit suspicious. Just as Mahesh, the Maharishi, gave two origin stories for transcendental meditation. And I think that what we'd be saying is that with both stellate ganglion block and EMDR, if we put it in close to layman's terms, we have a panic reaction. We have the fight, flight, freeze, fawn reaction. And that's stimulated. And what's being said is that you can calm down that panic reaction in somebody by using either an anesthetic or a hypnotic technique. And it will calm it down. That not always, but beyond
right.
placebo, beyond, you know, the sort of 30% that you might expect from placebo. And looking at the papers on stellate ganglion block, they actually are saying it prepares you for therapy. They're not saying it cures it. They're saying it gets you ready to treat the stress. And I would say the same might be true for EMDR, but I don't think we do actually reprocess the trauma until we've understood it. And certain aspects of EMDR, like being able to express your trauma in a single sentence. Also, the $500 a year relicensing fee from the association that trains people. also some very questionable methods in their training. Like, for example, telling counsellors, this happened to a friend of mine who's a master's degree counsellor, long term. And she went on one of their courses and was told, right, well, the next time you're with a client, ask if you can film the session for your records. And at the end of the session, ask if you can show us the film. You're kind of going, that's unethical. That is fundamentally unethical. Lying to your client. So, you know, with another agenda, with something else you want to do. So question those things. And I again, Bessel van der Kolk is the great advocate of this. And as I say, he's really taken a fall. If you go and look at what's happened to him in the last 5 or 6 years, he's had to leave the US. So
you're great at picking out the problems with anything that looks like it's helpful. And that's so important. I mean, I think you recognize things that sometimes are taken for granted, and that's so important. So keep it up.
Yeah, but and I would also say that trauma-based cognitive behavioral therapy has scored about a 50% success rate in, you know, so about 20% above placebo, so definitely worth considering. And maybe if we had ways of, you know, because I've talked with so many people who were so upset by the horrific things that have happened to them, and I think that there is a very important, simple aspect of this, which is if somebody cares, if somebody is concerned about how you feel, then it becomes possible to deal with the trauma. Whereas having a kind of clinical experience where you have a needle in your neck and, you know, it is the concern that people have, and we have a difficulty there. I don't charge people to talk to me. That was a decision I made a long time ago because, well, they didn't have any money. So what was I going to do about that? They were coming out of a cult that had robbed them blind. And so if I was going to help them, and as the years went by, I came to realize that this had become an important part of the therapeutic system, that it wasn't a 50-minute hour where they were giving me, I have a friend who won't take money from anybody until 6 months after he last sees them. And he's lived in poverty for 50 years, you know, because I'm afraid that's the way it goes. I was lucky. I was able to beg enough money to keep doing this and earn a bit here and there from court cases and journalism. But I think that therapeutic relationship, we might call it, but that somebody really does care about you, that makes it so much easier to deal with the trauma that we've experienced.
Well, yes, but you probably know this better than me. In what way do they care? I mean, I would probably put in being induced into a cult as being exposed to somebody who's saying they care about you. So what is the goal of the caring, and how objective and caring in developing what the term you probably use, but I know Steve Hazan uses, is freedom of the mind. Do you want the person to develop freedom of mind, which I think is essential to psychiatry? Do you want them to have freedom of mind or not? Because the cult stuff obviously goes in the other direction. So it's really the kind of caring and how it's done, and what the caring person is all about that's crucial here. And I certainly think you're right. There could be many lay people who can be that kind of person. But again, it can be tricky and you can be fooled. So you being the one who's been traumatized. So, you know, maybe we should get a whole listing of these lay people who are caring, that are, you know, available to help others in this way. So
would that there were such a lot of people, but there aren't. There are very, very few people. I have my one friend in this country who, as I say, has spent 50 years doing this, Christian Sherko, who is absolutely remarkable, wonderful man.
But you do hear about natural therapists, in quotes. You know, if they are out there in society, you know, they are the people who try to help people who are traumatized or, you know, in mental despair for one reason or another, and people go to them because they have this kind of aura and way about them. So I think there are more of those than are obvious. Now, to really deal with the big severe stuff like you do, yeah, there's less of those people because they can also get overwhelmed by the subject matter. But I think there, in general, there's more of these natural healers and therapists out there than we realize. People who are barbers and in salons, with women, often take on that kind of role, right? They listen to people's troubles and do it in a caring and diverting kind of setting, almost like, a different kind of the situations we've just been talking about. So.
I think those are very valid points, and let me reflect that when you're being recruited into a cult and the person is showing care for you, that care is often genuine. And the person recruiting you doesn't realize that they are being preyed upon by the leader to do this. And so sometimes it kind of releases the willingness to show care and concern for others. Then, of course, you get trapped because, the end of the day, you will be expected to hand all your money over. And then the other thing is, I was on a flight to Chicago, actually, many years ago, and there was a couple, an Armenian couple there in their 80s, and the man said to me, "My wife and I have had eight unnecessary surgeries because we have such good health insurance."
Wow.
And then he said, "But at least we don't have your socialist medicine." And I think you may have misunderstood the socialist mail service, the socialist police service, the socialist fire service that does exist in America, and without which things wouldn't go on. It's a misapprehension of this terrible word socialist. We have a health system which, if it were properly funded, which it never has been, would probably provide the necessary psychotherapy. At the moment, we have 2-year waiting lists, which is ludicrous. And there is that sense of the transaction that's taking place, that when you meet somebody who's, is a therapy, a natural therapist, a therapeutic personality, you feel better after talking to them and maybe getting something into our educational system about how to communicate with people and make them feel better would be a really useful step for us to take, rather than, this is your device and how to use it, which is about what we seem to be learning at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, I maybe told you this, I view my wife as a natural therapist, right? So I
Oh,
may have
she is.
learned
She definitely is.
almost as much from watching her deal with people than, that I learned formally in my training. So, yeah.
Isn't that fascinating? And I, yeah, that's true that there are people that give you comfort. There are people that, I mean, you told me, I think it was in our first conversation, that you used to be accident prone as a young man, and then you met Rusty, and things got a lot easier.
Lot better, yes. I stayed alive and stopped having accidents, and yeah, right, exactly. That was a major cure.
Well, absolutely and utterly wonderful. Thank you so much, Steve. And we will get together again in a month or two and chew some more fat.
Sounds good.
Grand. Thanks a lot, and thanks to everybody for watching us.
Yes, thanks on my side too to you and the audience, and hope we said something useful.
Yes, let's hope we did say something useful. Thanks, Steve.
Okay.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.